Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started. So I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, and we hope you have a great holiday season.
This is The Scoop, a weekly regional roundup of stories from remote radio stations in British Columbia. Each week, The Scoop features news created by fellow LJI journalists in the communities of Smithers, Prince George, Nanaimo, Burnaby, and the Comox Valley. LJI is the local journalism initiative, and it's how your best local news is funded on these participating stations. Now, let's see what's happening this week in BC.
Today on The Scoop, the BC Human Rights Commissioner says the province needs to prioritize evidence over stigma when addressing the toxic drug crisis across BC. Danny Nesvarandi at CJSF in Burnaby has more. MLA for Nanaimo Lanceville, George Anderson, is currently moving forward with a private members bill, Bill M216, the Professional Reliance Act, which would change how local governments accept technical reports on housing developments. Lauren McKenzie at CHLY in Nanaimo has that story. And in Prince Rupert, after years of struggles to increase local food production, School District 52 and a local EcoTrust project may finally be growing enough food to establish a community market. I'll have that story coming right up. I'm Daniel Messick, and you're listening to The Scoop.
Reporting from Vancouver, BC, this is Danny Nesvarandi, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. On November 13th, BC Human Rights Commissioner Kasari Govender released a statement regarding the provincial government's ongoing response to BC's toxic drug crisis. In the statement, Govender calls on the BC government to emphasize evidence-based policies in order to address the crisis, accusing their current focus on criminalization and involuntary care as being influenced by stigma. To learn more about Govender's statement, as well as what proposed actions she believes the province should be taking in order to address the toxic drug crisis, we sat down for a conversation where she was able to explain her reasons for releasing this statement.
So we released a position statement on the toxic drug crisis. In many ways, it reflects what many experts in the field have been saying for a long time, and it brings that into a human rights perspective, essentially arguing that, you know, in order to respect the human rights of folks directly who are directly impacted, people who use substances, who come from all walks of life, some of whom deal with substance dependence, addiction, but some of whom don't. All folks, to prioritize their rights, we need to take policy steps that are rooted in the evidence rather than in ideology. So that means prioritizing, for example, safe supply, access to safe supply, and harm reduction services rather than emphasizing criminal law responses to the toxic drug crisis.
We then asked Govender to expand on her statement that the BC government's actions towards the toxic drug crisis were being driven by stigma of drug use and drug users.
I worry that the response has been based on, in part at least, on kind of an understanding that, you know, prioritizing, first of all, kind of the perspective that this is about safety on our streets for non-drug users, rather than prioritizing the lives and the human rights of those who do use substances. That's not to say that all of us don't want safe streets. that all of us benefit from communities where we feel like ourselves and our families, our children are safe in our parks and in our public spaces. We absolutely do. And happily for us, getting more safety in our streets and our parks is the same as respecting people's human rights who actually use drugs, which is we need a solution to this problem. You know, a lot of people in the wake of this, with much of the negative comments in the wake of releasing the statement have been, you don't care about the problem. You don't care about the people who are dying. You just think people should be able to kind of use drugs and as much as they want, and you're sort of promoting their suffering. In fact, this is the opposite. This is about saying what actually addresses the toxicity of drugs. These are the substances that are killing people or causing serious brain damage. You know, let's actually get to what the real solutions are. And the evidence shows that the real solutions lie in these kinds of public policy responses that may not intuitively at first feel right. But it's not about what's intuitive. It's actually about what the evidence supports. So I very much want to address the toxic drug supply. I very much want to ensure that people are not dying and seriously injured through toxic drugs. And ultimately, that will make all of us safer, whether we're directly impacted by this crisis from someone we love in our lives or ourselves, or just because we see this around us in our communities.
Later on in our conversation, we asked Kasari Govender to provide examples of different places in Canada as well as the world that have enacted policies similar to what she is advocating for.
I mean, I think every context is different for sure. We can look to certain countries in Europe, we can look to Portugal and others to see how some of these policies have rolled out. Unfortunately, you know, the evidence from Canada either hasn't been listened to or hasn't been given enough time to play out. So, but we can see the evidence of how we've done so far under a prohibition model. Under a model where access to substances is illegal rather than the focus being on the safety of the substances that people are accessing. And we can see that because this drug toxicity crisis has arisen in the context of a prohibition model. It's arisen in the context of the existing, you know, legal structure, which says that drugs are criminalized and that therefore we wouldn't try to make the drug supply safer. We would just try to eliminate it altogether. Well, that's great in theory, but that actually hasn't worked. That's exactly what gave rise to this situation in the first place.
Lastly, Kasari Govender left us with some more suggestions for what she believes needs to be prioritized when addressing the toxic drug crisis in BC.
So in my view, it's this position, again, despite how it's sometimes being represented, this position is not opposed to all forms of involuntary care. Sometimes involuntary care can be the right step from a human rights perspective if it is the last resort. If the science backs up that people will actually come out better than healthier than they went in, and that they have the right safeguards in place so that they can challenge the fact that they're being detained against their will or the conditions under which they're being detained. Those are all vital elements of having an involuntary care system. But even before we get to that point, we need to ask ourselves where we're spending all of our energy and money and resources in terms of addressing this crisis. Where we need to be spending that is getting access to treatment options that exist now voluntarily. Putting aside for a second, you know, we need access to safe supply, we need harm reduction facilities, we also need access to voluntary mental health services. You know, I think probably everyone listening, I certainly can draw multiple examples from my community, of loved ones, family and friends, of folks who tried desperately to get access to services and were unable to do it. And that worsened their mental health, it worsened their reliance on substances because there just weren't the resources available at that front end. Let's invest properly in services where people can actually choose to access services. That is a human rights respecting model, respects people's agency. But in addition to that, we also respect the science. what the, you know, I'm not a scientist, I'm a lawyer. That's partly why we put together this statement, so that we could look at the evidence out there and ensure that, you know, we weren't basing this kind of legal model in something that doesn't have actual basis in life. But what we see is that the evidence backs up the use of voluntary care services, that backs up safe supply, backs up harm reduction. And so we know that, you know, there's some really problematic evidence about what happens when people are put into involuntary care only for substance use disorder. So were they not for other mental health issues, but only for substance use disorder. And then they come out and sometimes are more vulnerable and are more likely to overdose and die as a result. So we need to make sure that we gain we're making policy decisions that are actually based in the evidence.
Once again, that was our conversation with BC Human Rights Commissioner Kasari Govender on a statement she made where she claims that the BC government is currently addressing the toxic drug crisis through policies that stem from stigma rather than evidence. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM.
This is a CHY News Update. MLA for Nanaimo Lanceville, George Anderson, is currently moving forward with a private member's bill that has sparked concern among local governments. Bill M216, Professional Alliance Act, introduced by Anderson, would change how local governments accept technical reports on housing developments by certified professionals. The bill is now in its committee stage after passing its second reading last week. If passed, local governments would have to accept reports prepared by certified professionals under the Professional Governments Act, or PGA, without staff review of any engineering reports or architectural designs. Anderson says these changes would reduce the amount of work needed, allowing building projects to be started more quickly, delivering more homes in the province. MLA George Anderson spoke with CHY about his new bill.
Bill M216 is all about trying to bring the dream that many young people and families have of owning a home back into reality, and also have affordable housing, because every day, month, and year of delay are costs that are passed on to the end user, whether that's students who are trying to afford a place to rent in Nanaimo or Vancouver or Vernon, whether or not you're a first-time prospective home buyer. Every month of delay costs more.
Anderson explains that currently, when a builder hires a professional, such as an engineer, geoscientist, or architect, for a building project, the professional must prepare technical reports and submit them to the relevant local government. The local government may then review the work.
Staff that are over capacity in the sense of the work that they need to do, it may mean that it may take a significant amount of time before an individual actually reviews that work. And so the faster that we're able to bring homes to market means that people who are looking to buy a home or to rent will end up having cheaper homes. And that's what the intent of this bill is to make sure that we can deliver homes for people faster.
This bill has already sparked some criticism over how it could disrupt local government approval authorities. President of the Union of British Columbia Municipalities, Corey Ramsey, told CHY that they are worried that the bill could undermine public safety and increase liability for local governments, putting homeowners and taxpayers at risk.
Homeowners and renters expect that due diligence has been provided when they move into a newly built home. And the purpose of peer review by local government staff is to ensure that there aren't errors in submissions that will lead to health, safety, or other problems in builds. You know, the public might not be aware of this, but local government staff catch a lot of things developers have missed, and we work with developers to get it right. That's such a huge piece of the development process. And the process MLA Anderson is proposing will really make it harder for local governments to act, even when they see significant health and safety risks.
Anderson says that while this bill could cut some red tape from the approval process, getting housing built faster is a top priority and would allow local governments to focus on other important projects.
It's right in the legislation. It says that local communities, local governments are still in charge of zoning, bylaws, and official community plans. This bill would give local governments the opportunity to be able to focus on more high-level work, which would be great for our community, and further limit the liability that local governments have. So that means that the local government couldn't be sued. And I think that's actually a positive thing, because that means that that local government can spend money on buying parkland, fixing the roads, and creating the type of communities that we all want to live in.
While Ramsey understands the need for more housing throughout the province, she says there are just too many red flags in the bill to go untouched.
This bill expands the definition of a qualified professional, and now you're getting agrologists and biologists and people who don't have the same level of life safety experience in approving these types of really important pieces of infrastructure in our communities.
If passed in its current form, Ramsey says the bill will prevent local governments from conducting peer reviews of submissions made by a registered PGA professional. Under the legislation, municipalities will still have the chance to dispute any concerns with the PGA superintendent's office about whether the work should be redone. But this, Ramsey says, will just lead to more delays and higher costs for developers while they wait for an answer from the superintendent. She also touches on the risk the bill poses by shifting liability for damages from the local government to the PGA professional.
But what happens when a developer doesn't have the right liability coverage? What happens if, you know, you're building a commercial building and there's a $20 million deficiency and they only have $3 million worth of coverage? It's the taxpayer that's going to be on the hook for the difference. And so when I say this bill is broken, there's really some huge pieces to this that haven't been considered. And we want to make sure that taxpayers are protected.
While the bill has sparked some criticism, Anderson tells CHOI that he is open to working with the UBCM and other concerned groups to make sure all voices are heard now that the bill is in the committee stage.
And what I can tell you is I want to work with people. I want to work with UBCM. I want to work with engineers and geoscientists of British Columbia because people want us to work together. Like, housing isn't a partisan issue. We should all be coming together and saying, here's a bill that's been brought forward that can help a lot of people. Let's see how we can make it work.
With the bill in the committee stage, people can leave feedback through a portal on the Legislative Assembly of British Columbia website. Feedback can be given until January 6th of next year. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
Today on CSAK News, after years, Prince Rupert may finally be getting a local vegetable market. After a council delegation this past week from EcoTrust's Diana Veliche and School District 52's food coordinator, Nadia Howard, about their program building local community gardens at all the elementary schools throughout Prince Rupert to increase local food production. I had a chance to catch up with them after the delegation at council this week in Prince Rupert.
My name is Diane Vilsesh and I work with EcoTrust Canada. I'm the program manager for land-based food systems. We initially started working on community engagement around food security, and while we were doing that work, we were approached by PHABC, Public Health Association of British Columbia, and they wanted to invest in a couple of northern communities. They didn't know which one yet. And so we presented some ideas of what we'd like to do. And lucky for us, they were very happy to support us. And so with our community engagement that we had done just over a year ago in Prince Rupert, it helped to inform the project. Essentially, we did a World Cafe style community meetings. The public was invited. We had over 35 community members attend, and they gave us their ideas and things that mattered to them, and we used that information to essentially write the proposal that PHABC accepted.
My name is Nadia Hallward, and I work for the school district here in Prince Rupert.
Great, Nadia. One thing that came up there was that a lot of this food is going to be used for school food programs, and that it was pointed out that we do have the highest child poverty rate in the province here in Prince Rupert. And you know, hearing that statistic, it's quite shocking for, you know, a relatively small town. Why is this an issue? Why has the school district focused on creating this food program, and how, you know, how big, how sufficient is it, and how much is this going to help make it even better?
So the Prince Rupert School District has had a school meal program for quite a long time. I can say over 30 years in place. It has grown, of course, over the years, and with the funding that came through the provincial government, the Feeding Futures funding, my job was created, for one, to improve and enhance the school meal programs, which we have been working on steadily. And part of that is to integrate more local and traditional foods into the menu as well. And so because the demand is quite high for the meal programs, having the food from locally grown sources will, A, help our economics with the meal program. It also brings in the freshest possible food that students can get. So nutrition-wise, they're getting amazing quality food into their bellies, trying new things that students maybe have never tried before, being able to see the source of the food, which is actually very rare in Prince Rupert because we don't have a lot of agriculture here. So giving students that chance to connect their food system, to see the whole cycle of food.
I saw a mention of even integrating agricultural studies program into the curriculum. Tell me about that, because you're right. You know, we see a lot of agriculture in Terrace area all the way to the Bulkley Valley. But here, you know, obviously it's virtually unheard of. And it sounds like there was a bit of excitement from some of the counselors around.
Yeah, so I think the greater vision of this project as it evolves and grows in the community is to create a board authorized course for agriculture or urban agriculture, whatever we end up calling it in the end, to support these greenhouses, but mainly to get students involved in growing and learning how to do it and how to do it specifically in Prince Rupert to generate that interest. Because we don't have farms that you can walk down to and see what's happening easily, there are other schools in BC that have these courses. So Sea to Sky School District in Squamish has a board-authorized agriculture course, and Sardis Secondary, I believe, in Chilliwack has one. So using them as kind of models to build off of, I think we can achieve that here for our students.
Why is EcoTrust focused on this here in Rupert?
Well, actually, EcoTrust is involved in creating opportunities and finding ways to support economies that provide for life. So if you visit our website, you'll see that we have a fisheries component, we have homelands, we work with Indigenous nations to help further their projects as well. And so where we see a need in small, rural, remote communities is where we tend to land. And the need is very great in Prince Rupert. A lot of our staff actually live in Prince Rupert, where over 90% of our staff is based in BC. And we have a fairly large group of folks who work in fisheries and around fisheries. And we also work with mariculture, with Metlakatla around mariculture and land-based food systems. And so there is a real need there, the highest child poverty rate in the province. And food security is important, and we have so many challenges in Prince Rupert, you know, lack of arable land, lack of seafood access, highest child poverty rate. So all these things compounded are really, you know, it's necessary for us to do this work and help the community.
Just the last thing for you. There are several of these operations happening at schools. It sounds like there are plans to expand into more community, neighborhood-based gardens as well. But just the notion of having a market or a vegetable market or a seafood market, same thing, caused a bit of excitement when you don't often see that. Why did you want to come and present to Prince Rupert Council tonight? Do you see the support there to, not only from council, but from the community to grow that and actually finally have some sort of local seafood, local market here in Rupert? Mm-hmm.
So we were involved, we actually partnered with the city and with the school district and the Gitmat Mackay Niska Society to work on a community food action plan, and the city is also working on their own food strategy. So we all came together to do some engagement with the community, and so that's where a lot of these ideas were born out of. And so the market, we're excited to start that hopefully in May or June this next year. And you know, a lot of community members that have participated in these meetings and have come to some of the events that we've had. Like, we recently had a food symposium where we were sharing the work that we were doing, but we also wanted to see what other community members were doing and what they wanted. So we had some harvesters, food artisans, growers, and so it was really kind of cool to have all the people together and talk about, you know, what was important and share what they were doing. And so there was such excitement around the food symposium as well that, you know, we're just excited to start a market garden. I think there's a need for it. We want to be able to support local growers who maybe you grow too many carrots and you want to sell some to the community, or maybe, you know, you harvest mushrooms and you make the most amazing pickled chanterelles and you want to sell to the community. So there's all kinds of people that have their little niche of things that they love to do that is, you know, around food and food centered. And so it's just a really great opportunity to showcase that. And, you know, with the community gardens, we're excited to be part of that and to help help set that up so that the community can benefit as a whole.
That's it for this week's Scoop. Catch us next week, Thursdays at 12 p.m. in Smithers, Thursdays at 4 p.m. in Burnaby, Fridays at 8 a.m. in Nanaimo, and weekdays at 7:30 in Prince George. The Scoop was made possible by funding from the Canadian government and the Local Journalism Initiative, a Community Radio Fund of Canada initiative.
This is Bird Note. Some birds are much more efficient flyers than others. They get more power out of each flap of the wing. Birds that capture their food with their beaks while in flight are the best flyers of all. But there's a trade-off. Feet have many uses, but for a flying bird, they're a drag, literally. So birds that pursue prey on the wing have evolved weaker feet than other birds. Just like with airplanes and rockets, reducing the weight of anything not needed for propulsion increases flight efficiency. Both swallows, which snatch flying insects out of the air, and hummingbirds, which catch their prey and gather nectar in flight, have weak feet. They can perch, but they can't walk. And swifts, the birds most highly adapted for flight, have such weak feet that they can't even perch. They can only hang by their long claws or shuffle a few inches. But in return, swifts can fly rapidly and efficiently, and they have great maneuverability. They and their close relatives, those hummingbirds, are the only birds that can fly straight up. That enables the swifts to exit chimneys and cavities in trees where they nest. Now that's an efficient flyer. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Music has always been important to Corinne Stein. The daughter of a musician, she grew up in rural Colombia and was surrounded by local folk music.
Music has been, since I arrived in the U.S., the way to keep my cultural background with me. And whatever I do with music always comes deeply from the heart and from my soul.
So she says music is a natural way for her to share her concerns about climate change and pollution, which disproportionately affect Latino communities. Stein is the director of Eco Musica, a project of Moms Clean Air Force and leader of the Son Tierra Ensemble. This group of Latino musicians writes and performs songs that call for cleaner air and climate action.
We have the words in our songs, but I don't think the words, right off the bat, is what people remember. What they first resonate with is the rhythm, the harmonies, just the emotional part of sounds, of music. And then that becomes a vehicle to further conversation.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Thank you.
staff and volunteers at CJSF wish you a jolly, merry, happy, joyful, fantastic, exciting, fancy, magnificent, remarkable, special, white, sparkling, terrific, stunning, festive, and wonderful holiday season.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoff, and this is edition 296. On the broadcast this week, I'm going to be sharing a conversation with a member of the Tasmanian Palestine Advocacy Network. You can find them